Most effective ways to practice habit 2, begin with the end in mind, is to write 4 eulogies that you'd like to have given at your own funeral. One by a loved one, one by a friend, one by a work associate, and one by someone you served within your church or community. For the first time, as I watched my father pass from this world, and as we prepared his funeral, I took seriously the writing of a personal mission statement where I would clarify in a deep sense what matters most to me. Close quote. Now, after you have the foundation of identifying mission and values in this productivity pyramid, you want to identify your most important roles, such as family member, church community worker, friend, mother, father, team leader, and then set goals for the week that are aligned with those values and associated with the roles you have identified. The personal planning tool will help you set goals that are attainable and that you will be accountable to yourself for, and that you can break down into smaller goals. Your level of commitment to those goals will be directly correlated to how connected they are to your values. A clear awareness of your roles and goals enables you to balance your life. The third level of the pyramid is weekly planning. During this planning time, you have a chance to reflect on your roles, choose the big rocks, that is the most important things, and plan those in first as you begin to schedule your week. This leads you into daily planning, wherein you make realistic task lists, prioritize tasks, and review scheduled appointments for the day. The book I co-authored with Rebecca and Roger Merrill, entitled First Things First, goes deeply into these areas of personal mission statements and planning systems for those who are interested. If you only do daily planning outside the larger context of your values and your goals for each of your roles in life, and outside of weekly planning, I'll guarantee you you'll spend your time in firefighting and crisis management. Urgency will define importance, and you will become addicted to it. You'll spend your stressed life in the thick of thin things, often claiming how free you are. Now let's see a film so that we can visualize these ideas. In the book First Things First, we introduced a perfect metaphor for achieving life balance and accomplishing those things that matter most to us. We captured a live, unrehearsed demonstration of this metaphor on video at one of my seminars. It is entitled Big Rocks, and in its own way, it communicates how we can use our 3 birth gifts, choice, principles, and the 4 human intelligences to create positive changes in our lives. You may now watch the video on the book's companion DVD. There are many lessons to be learned from this exercise. The most important is very simple. Put the big rocks in first. If you fill your bowl or your life with pebbles first, and then you have a major crisis with one of your children, a financial or health setback, or a significant new creative opportunity, what are you going to do? Those things are big rocks, and there is no room left for them in your life. Always think in terms of big rocks first. Determine what is most important in your life and make your decisions based on those very important criteria. The big rocks are simply those things that matter most in your life. Again, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Your 3 supernal birth gifts give you the power to make such choices and truly become the creative force of your own life. With a burning yes around your high priorities, you can easily say no to things that are urgent but not important. Smilingly, cheerfully, guilt-free, no. A common question asked me all the time is, it makes sense that you've got to have trustworthy people in your organization to have trust, but what do you do if you have customers that abuse and mishandle your trustworthy employees and do it consistently? My answer is, fire the customers. I know of an extremely prominent retail organization that actually writes letters to customers who, when it becomes evident to everybody, persist in mistreating employees. They've actually said to the customers they do not want their business. However, of course, the better and higher solution is to seek some third alternative solution with good communication. Always, of course, listening first. New heading: The Voice and Speed of Trust. George MacDonald put it wisely, "It is a greater compliment to be trusted than to be loved." When we seek to expand our influence and inspire others to find their voice, remember now that inspire means to breathe life into another, we move into a world of relationships. Building strong relationships not only requires a character foundation of inner security, abundance, and personal moral authority, as expressed in the first part of this book, but it also involves stretching ourselves and developing vital new interpersonal skills that will make us equal to the challenges we will face with others. The next two chapters on modeling are focused on developing these skills. Almost all of the work of the world is done through relationships with people and in organizations. But what is communication like when there is no trust? It's impossible. It's like walking through a minefield. What if your communication is clear and precise, yet there is no trust? You'll always be looking for hidden meanings and the hidden agenda. A lack of trust is the very definition of a bad relationship. In the words of my son Stephen, low trust is the great hidden tax. In fact, this hidden tax is greater than all taxes and interest combined, hidden and unhidden. New heading: The Speed of Trust. Now, what is communication like when there is high trust? It's easy. It's effortless. It's instantaneous. What about when there's high trust and you make mistakes? They hardly matter. People know you. Don't worry about it. I understand. Forget it. I know what you mean. I know you. No technology ever devised can do that. Perhaps in a sense, this is why the heart is more important than the brain. Someone may be brain dead, but if their heart is still pumping, they live on. When your heart is dead, you're dead. As my son Stephen says, there is nothing as fast as the speed of trust. It's faster than anything you can think about. It's faster than the internet, for when trust is present, mistakes are forgiven and forgotten. Trust is the glue of life. It's the glue that holds organizations, cultures, and relationships together. Ironically, it comes from the speed of going slow. With people, fast is slow, and slow is fast. Several years ago, I was visiting with a friend who had recently completed a major business project. I was well acquainted with his work and congratulated him on the tremendous positive impact it was having on the lives of thousands. I asked him what he had learned. He said, "You know, Stephen, I'm sure I will look back on this 2-year project as one of the most important contributions of my life." Then, pausing, he slightly smiled and with a deep feeling continued, "But my real learning was that without a unified, close relationship with my wife, it all means nothing." "Really?" I replied. Sensing my interest, he then opened up and shared the following experience. "When I was first asked to take leadership of this project, I was thrilled with the opportunity. My wife and children were supportive, so I threw myself into it wholeheartedly. I felt a great weight of responsibility and was driven and energized with a sense of purpose. In the second year of the project, I worked literally day and night. The importance of the work consumed me. I felt I was doing well in staying involved in the kids' lives, including ball games and dance recitals. I usually had dinner each evening with the family. I thought I was managing pretty well. The last 6 months were the most intense. And it was during this time that I noticed how often my wife was becoming frustrated with me, usually over the smallest things, at least they seemed that way to me. I became increasingly irritated at her lack of understanding and support of the work I was doing. especially at such a critical time. Communication became more strained, even over minor issues. When the project was finally completed, she didn't even want to go to the celebration dinner. She went, but obviously didn't enjoy herself. I knew we had to talk. I mean, really talk. So we did, and the floodgates opened. She started to share what it was like to be alone all of this time. Even when I was home, she felt I was somewhere else. Because our tradition of having weekly dates became much less frequent, and because I usually stayed up long after she retired each night, we didn't talk and share like we used to. And she felt more and more isolated, unappreciated, and disconnected. I wasn't communicating much of anything. My nearly single-minded focus on my work and other commitments became a constant reminder of where my thoughts and feelings were focused. She reminded me that I had forgotten her birthday until the day was half over. And it wasn't the forgetting that was so bad, as it was a symbol of what the whole year had seemed like. When I asked her why she hadn't opened up and shared her concerns earlier, she said she didn't want to upset me and distract me from the project. I looked in her eyes and saw deep pain and loneliness. I felt horrible. I was amazed and embarrassed that I had been so clueless. Her openness about her loneliness helped me realize how empty I had been for so long. We had both become less effective, both personally and together. I apologized and reassured her that there was no person or thing on earth more important to me than her. But my words didn't seem to get through. I realized that too many other things had communicated something different for too long. My apology and commitment to reprioritize my life helped, but it didn't make things all better overnight. It took days and weeks and months of consistent effort, talking, sharing, being there, making and keeping promises, putting aside work at the end of the day for the family, and apologizing and regrouping when I got a little off track. Before the full feeling of trust and emotional connection was restored and exceeded even what it had been before. Close quote. Since I visited with my friend, he has completed two more multi-year projects just as demanding and significant as the first. Yet his relationship with his wife has grown stronger through each one. His painful first experience and his increased understanding of and commitment to his wife has brought lasting change. Looking back on the contrast in his experiences, he recently shared these additional insights with me. This is the way he put it. My real learning was that you could be deeply committed to a marriage, love your spouse, live in fidelity and loyalty toward each other, be committed to raising your children, and still have your relationship and trust deteriorate. You don't have to speak harsh, unkind words or be disrespectful to hurt someone. With one who is very close to you, all it takes is neglecting the heart, mind, and spirit. Relationships and trust do not remain constant. They are maintained and deepened only as you actively nurture and build them with regular acts of kindness, consideration, appreciation, and service. I learned that both the quality of our marriage and my own happiness had very little to do with what she was doing for me, and everything to do with what I was trying to do every day to foster her happiness, to share her burdens, and to partner with her in the things we care most about. I've learned that unity in my relationship with my wife is one of the greatest enabling sources of power of my life, not only in our most significant work in the family and community together, but in every area of my life, including professionally. It creates a well of strength, peace, joy, belonging, and energy that fuels my best work, creativity, and drive to contribute. Finally, I'm learning that strong relationships require real effort and sacrifice. They require putting someone else's well-being, growth, and happiness before your own. And oh, how it's worth it, for such effort is the door to our own happiness. What would we do without the pull of such relationships that help us get outside ourselves and become equal to our potential? Close quote. New heading, Moral Authority and the Speed of Trust. My friend's experience is a tremendous illustration of the reality that relationships are governed by natural laws. Enduring trust in a relationship cannot be faked, and it is rarely produced by a dramatic one-time effort. It is the fruit of regular actions inspired by the conscience and heart. In the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, I introduced a metaphor for trust called the emotional bank account. It is like a financial bank account into which you make deposits and take out withdrawals. Only in this case, you make emotional deposits and withdrawals in your relationships that either build or destroy them. Like any metaphor, if you push it far enough, it has its limitations. But generally, it is a powerful and simple way of communicating the quality of a relationship. I believe that there are 10 key deposits and withdrawals we can make with others that, in my experience, have a profound impact on the level of trust in our relationships. Let me briefly mention these deposits and withdrawals and the sacrifices required, as well as the principles embodied in each deposit. And then we'll go into greater depth on each. First deposit. Seek first to understand. Withdrawal. Seek first to be understood. The sacrifice required. Impatience. Ego. Your agenda. The internalized principles. Mutual understanding. Second deposit. Keeping promises. Withdrawal. Breaking promises. The sacrifice required. Moods, feelings, emotions, time. The principle. Integrity. Execution. Third deposit. Honesty and openness. The withdrawal. Smooth manipulation. The sacrifice. Ego. Arrogance. Control. The principles. Vision, values, integrity, execution. And mutual understanding. Fourth deposit, kindnesses and courtesies, the withdrawal, unkindnesses and discourtesies, the sacrifice, self, time, perceptions, stereotypes, prejudices, the principles, vision, values, integrity, execution. The fifth deposit, win-win or no-deal thinking. The withdrawal, win-lose or lose-win thinking. The sacrifice required. Winning means to beat. Competitiveness. The principle, mutual respect and benefit. The sixth deposit, clarifying expectations. The withdrawal, violating expectations. The sacrifice, kiss-up style communication. The principles, mutual respect and benefit, mutual understanding, creative cooperation, and renewal. The seventh deposit, loyalty to the absent. The withdrawal, disloyalty, duplicity. The sacrifice, some social acceptance and heart massage. The internalized principle, values, vision, integrity, execution. The eighth deposit, apologies. The withdrawal, pride, conceit, arrogance. The sacrifice, ego, arrogance, pride, time. The principles, vision and values, integrity, execution. The ninth deposit, receiving feedback and giving I messages. The withdrawal, not receiving feedback, and giving you messages that judge another. The sacrifice required, ego, arrogance, pride, and reactive communication. The principle, mutual understanding. The tenth deposit, forgiveness. The withdrawal, holding grudges. The sacrifice required, pride and self-centeredness. The principle, vision, values, integrity, and execution. It is important to recognize that the reason the 10 deposits build trust is that they embody principles central to human relationships. When you study each of these 10 deposits, what would you say are the common elements? I suggest that one common denominator of the deposits is initiative, which is made up of willpower and determination. You'll notice that every one of them lies within your own power to do. Every one of them lies within your own ability to influence. Because they are based on principles, they produce moral authority or trust. You can see how there is no way you can make those deposits, exercise that courage, that initiative, that determination, without the ability to do the 20 emotional, personal push-ups at the personal level that I spoke about earlier. What is the second common characteristic of the deposits? I suggest it's the absence of selfishness and the presence of humility. It's the willingness to subordinate oneself to another person, to a principle, or to a higher cause. It's realizing that life is not just about me and mine. Using the words of the philosopher Martin Buber, it's about I and thou. Feeling profound reverence for the worth and potential of every person. Moral authority, trust, and bonding can evaporate over time in the absence of making continual deposits, particularly with people we work and live around all of the time. This is so because their expectations are so much higher. With people we haven't seen for years, we can often pick up what we left off. The trust and bonding and love are restored immediately because there are simply no expectations of continual depositing. A good definition of moral authority is this: the principled exercise of free choice, which almost always involves some form of sacrifice. A third common characteristic is that, like most worthwhile things in life, they require a sacrifice. Remember, a good definition of sacrifice is giving up something, even something good, for something better. If you are already familiar with the emotional bank account, I encourage you to see it here with new eyes and open yourself to new added insights that will enable you to find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. You'll notice that each deposit represents a choice to use your birth gifts in an effort to sacrifice an ineffective personal habit and replace it with an action that builds moral authority in relationships with others. Before we go into each of these deposits in greater depth, consider this very brilliant, wise statement from Gordon B. Hinckley. No system can long command the loyalties of men and women which does not expect of them certain measures of discipline, and particularly self-discipline. The cost in comfort may be great, the sacrifice may be real, but this very demanding reality is the substance of which comes character and strength and nobility. Permissiveness never produced greatness. Integrity, loyalty, and strength are virtues whose sinews are developed through the struggles that go on within as we practice self-discipline under the demands of a divinely spoken truth. Let's look at these deposits. Seeking first to understand. Why would seek first to understand be the first deposit? One simple reason. You do not know what a deposit is to another person until you understand them from their frame of reference. What may be a high-level deposit to you may be a low-level deposit to another, or even a withdrawal. What may be an important promise to you may be unimportant to another. How you express your honesty, openness, kindness, and courtesy may be perceived completely differently when seen by others through their unique cultural or personal filters. While the underlying principle of each deposit holds true in every situation, it requires an understanding of others within their frame of reference to know how to specifically implement the practice. After learning of the idea of making deposits into the emotional bank account, one woman decided she was going to try it out. This is what she shared with me about her experience. I decided I would do something special for my husband to improve our relationship. I figured that having the kids in clean clothes when he got home and getting the laundry done quicker would really make him happier. After about 2 weeks of being Miss Super Washerwoman with no feedback from him, I mean nothing, I don't even think he had a clue. I started getting a little ticked. This stuff ain't worth nothing, I thought. Then suddenly, one night, when he'd gone thoughtlessly to sleep between clean sheets, I saw the light bulb click on above my head. Oh my gosh, he doesn't give a hoot about Zach's clean face or his clean jeans. That's what makes me happy. He'd rather have me scratch his back or organize a date for Friday night. I could have kicked myself. Here I was killing myself over laundry and making all these deposits that didn't mean a thing to him. I learned a simple truth in a very laborious way. A deposit must mean something to the other person. Close quote. I've had countless experiences of my own with the enabling power of seeking to understand another. I will never forget being invited by a very prestigious high-level executive to give my analysis and recommendations regarding the selection of a new university president. It was one of the most profound communication experiences I've ever had. He left his office to come into the outer office where I was awaiting my appointment. After greeting me, he graciously ushered me into his office and had me sit right next to him in front of his desk, where we could talk eye to eye without any physical structure between us. He basically said, "Stephen, thank you so much for coming in. I'm anxious to understand whatever you want me to understand." I had prepared for this visit for a considerable period of time and had developed an outline of my presentation. I gave him a copy of the outline and covered it slowly, point by point. Except for a few clarifying questions, he never interrupted. He listened so intently and completely that when my 30-minute presentation was over, I felt completely understood. He made absolutely no comment, neither agreeing, disagreeing, or committing. But at the end, he simply stood up, looked me in the eye, and as he shook my hand, expressed how much he appreciated and admired me. That was it. I was profoundly moved by his openness, humility, graciousness, and deep listening, and overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude and loyalty. Because I felt so completely understood and knew that my input had been genuinely listened to and respected, I was fully prepared to support whatever decision was made. Even though I had been with this gentleman many times before, that face-to-face, one-on-one, genuine communication experience conferred upon him such moral authority in my eyes that I never needed another visit or experience with him to renew it or to restore it. It is amazing to me, even at this writing, to feel the impact of such a precious conversation. Now let's look at the deposit of making and keeping promises. Nothing destroys trust faster than making and breaking a promise. Conversely, nothing builds and strengthens trust more than keeping a promise you make. It's easy to make a promise. It usually satisfies another quickly, particularly when they're stressed or anxious about something they need you to fix. When they're happy with the promise, they like you, and we like to be liked. That which we desire most earnestly, we believe most easily. Again, that which we desire most earnestly, we believe most easily. All kinds of people are suckered into deals and agreements because they want something so badly, they'll believe most any explanation, story, or promise of getting it. They turn a blind eye to negative information and go on in their believing. But promise keeping is hard. It usually involves a painful, sacrificial process, especially when the pleasant promise-making mood passes, or when hard realities descend, or when circumstances change. I've trained myself to never, You know, we're supposed to never say never. Use the word promise, unless I'm totally prepared to pay whatever the price is to keep it, especially with my children. They've often begged me to say promise. Then they feel at peace knowing I would come through, almost as if they had whatever they wanted now. But many times I was sorely tempted to say, I promise, just to quickly satisfy them and keep the peace at the moment. I'll try, or it's my goal, or I hope to, wouldn't satisfy. Only, I promise. Occasionally, when circumstances outside my control changed, I would ask my children to understand and relieve me of the promise. In most cases, they understood and relieved me. But my younger children usually didn't understand. Even though they said they did and freed me of the promise intellectually, they really didn't emotionally. So I kept the promise unless it was very unwise to do so. In such cases, I would have to temporarily live with the diminished trust and try to rebuild it slowly in other ways. New heading: Honesty and Integrity. Basketball coach legend Rick Pitino captured the principle of honesty simply and profoundly in this statement. Lying makes a problem part of the future. Truth makes a problem part of the past. I remember working once with a building contractor who was unbelievably upfront and open about the challenges he was facing, even the mistakes he had made on our project. He took responsibility for the mistakes. He gave such consistent, complete financial accounting, along with all the options that we could take advantage of in various stages of construction, that I absolutely and instinctively trusted the man and relied on his word from then on. I knew that if anything, he would put our interests ahead of his own. His willingness to put his integrity and our relationship above his pride and natural desire to both hide his mistakes and avoid embarrassment formed an unusual bond of trust between us. That trust earned him a great deal of business. I've also had the opposite experience several times with the same kinds of construction challenges. Nathaniel Hawthorne once said, "No man for any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be true." Another time when I was working at a university, I had the privilege of hosting a prominent psychologist who was the former president of the National Psychological Association. This man was considered the father of integrity therapy, a method of psychological treatment based on the idea that peace of mind, true happiness, and balance are a function of living a life of integrity to conscience. He believed that conscience tapped into the universal sense of right and wrong common to all enduring cultures, religions, and societies throughout time. One afternoon between lectures, I drove him into the mountains to see the breathtaking views. I took the opportunity to ask him how he came to believe in integrity therapy. He said, "It was very personal. I was a manic depressive, and most of my whole life has been a series of highs and lows. Over time, as I counseled people, I would begin to feel stressed and very vulnerable. I would start slipping into depression, almost to the point where I wanted to take my life. I had enough awareness of what was happening because of my professional education and work to know that I was dangerous. At this point, I would institutionalize myself to preclude taking my life. After a month or two, I would come out and go back into my work. Then after a year or so, I would slip back into it, hospitalize myself, and gradually come back to go on with my research and writing." He continued, "At one point when I was president of the association, I became so ill, so depressed, that I was unable to go to the meetings and take up the gavel of my office. At that point I asked myself, is it possible that I'm working out of the wrong framework in my life and profession? I knew deep inside that I had been living a lie for many years. There was a dark part of my life that I had not owned up to. As we were driving along and he began to share these things, I became very sobered and humbled. I was also a little scared of what he might say. He continued, "I decided to make a major break. I gave up my mistress. I came clean with my wife. And for the first time in many years, I had peace. A kind of peace that was different from what I had experienced when I came out of my depressions and went back into productive work. It was an inner kind of peace, an inner peace of mind, a kind of self-honesty, a kind of self-unity, and integrity. That's when I began to explore the theory that perhaps many of the problems I had were the result of the natural conscience being ignored, denied, violated, creating a loss of personal integrity. So I began to work with this idea. I researched it. I involved other clinicians who began working from this paradigm with their patients. Eventually, I became convinced from the data that this was the case, and that's what got me into integrity therapy." Close quote. This man's openness and the depth of his conviction powerfully impressed me, as it did hundreds of students the following day in a university forum, where to my absolute surprise he related the same story. Modeling and openness were central to his therapeutic approach. I am also impressed with how clear it became to him that personal integrity is central not only to all our relationships, but also to our psychological health and our power to be effective in our chosen life pursuits. New heading, Kindnesses and Courtesies. With people, little things are the big things. I once had a student come to me at the end of the semester and essentially say, after praising the class, "Dr. Covey, you are an expert in human relations, but you don't even know my name." He was right. I was chagrined, embarrassed, and properly chastened. I have to deal with my tendency to submerge myself in intellectual conceptualization, task orientation, and efficiency all of the time. You see, until relationships are strong and purposes are shared, efficiency is ineffective, particularly with insecure, high-maintenance people. Not so with things. Things have no feelings. People do. Even so-called big people, VIPs, small courtesies and kindnesses, given consistently, yield huge dividends. This is the realm of EQ, emotional intelligence. On the other hand, people see through superficial, kind techniques and know that they are being manipulated. Genuine kindness, courtesy, and respect come from a deep character reservoir of SQ, spiritual intelligence, and even obviate the necessity for a lot of social niceties and ceremonial-type courtesies. Often when I speak to children at home or school, I tell them that if they will learn to use four expressions, which total only 10 words, if they will do it sincerely and consistently, they can pretty much get what they want in almost every case. One word, please. 2 words, thank you. 3 words, I love you. 4 words, how may I help? Adults are big children. New heading, thinking win-win or no deal. Win-lose thinking is the underlying assumption of almost all negotiation and problem solving. It comes from society's scarcity mindset, which says the more the other guy wins or gets, the less there is for me. The goal is to get what you want, which usually means figuring out how to manipulate or gain the advantage over the other guy to get him to concede as much as possible. Many try to work out differences with others, even family members, in the same way. Both parties battle it out until one concedes or they settle on a compromise. I remember making a presentation in which I taught the idea that the key to breaking out of this win-lose mindset is to become emotionally and mentally settled on championing the other party's win as much as your own. It requires courage, abundant thinking, and great creativity to not settle on anything that is a compromise for either party. I taught that a further key was to begin with a no-deal option. In fact, until no deal is a viable option in your own mind, that is, until you are totally prepared to go for no deal, to walk away, to agree to disagree agreeably, unless both parties actually feel it is a win for them. You'll find yourself manipulating and often pressuring or intimidating others to go along with your win. But when no deal is truly a viable option up front, you can honestly say to the other, unless this is a true win for you, and you deeply and sincerely feel it, and unless it's a true win for me, and I deeply and sincerely feel it, let's agree right now to go for no deal. That process is so liberating, so freeing, and it requires such a combination of humility and kindness, with strength and courage, that once it is truly hammered out, both parties are transformed. Such intense bonding takes place that afterwards they will always be loyal to each other in each other's absence. After the presentation, a man who had been sitting on the front row came up to me to thank me for this very timely idea. He represented Disney Epcot and said he intended to practice it the very next day in a situation regarding the showcasing of a particular country at the Epcot Center. He explained that the people who were willing to supply much of the financing wanted a country exhibit that Disney felt would not hold enough general interest. They were feeling pressure to compromise in order to get the funding and development moving on time. But now he saw a new option. He later reported to me that he respectfully said to the funding source, "We really want to go for a win-win agreement and relationship with you. We certainly need the financing you're offering. But given our fundamental differences, we've concluded that if our agreement and joint project isn't genuinely going to be a big win for both of us, it would be better to go for no deal." As soon as the funding source sensed his sincerity, openness, and honesty of expression, they themselves stopped manipulating and pressuring. They backed up, regrouped, and then began genuine communication until a truly synergistic win-win arrangement was made. You'll notice that the power of this think-win-win or no-deal deposit lies in the initial willingness to sacrifice, to suspend your own interests long enough to understand what the other person wants most and why, so that you can then go to work together on a new creative solution that encompasses both of your interests. New heading, clarifying expectations. Clarifying expectations is really a combination of all the other deposits mentioned because of the amount of mutual understanding and respect required to drive such communication, particularly when it is about clarifying expectations around roles and goals. In fact, if you study the underlying roots of almost all communication breakdowns or broken, sick cultures, you'll find that they come from either ambiguous or broken expectations around roles and goals. In other words, who is to do what role, and what are the high-priority goals of those roles? Once I remember doing some team building with the top executives of a large restaurant association. It became so obvious that there were conflicting priorities and goals that could no longer be ignored or tolerated without terrible consequences for the entire organization. I simply took two flip charts and at the top of each put, "How you see my roles and goals," and "How you see your roles and goals." No judgments, no agreements or disagreements were expressed until both charts were filled out to the satisfaction of those filling them out. Just as soon as everyone could see with their own eyes that these seemingly irreconcilable differences were totally a function of different expectations about roles and goals, humility and respect were restored. They were then able to begin sincere communication in clarifying expectations. New heading, Being loyal to those not present. Being loyal to those not present is one of the most difficult of all of the deposits. It is one of the highest tests of both character and the depth of bonding that has taken place in a relationship. This is particularly the case when everyone seems to be joining in on bad-mouthing and piling on someone who is not present. But you can, in an unself-righteous way, just speak up and say, "I see it differently," or "My experience is different." Or you might say, "You have a point. Now let's go talk to him or her about it." By doing so, you instantly communicate that integrity is loyalty, not just to those absent, but also to those who are present. Whether they acknowledge it or not, all the people present will inwardly admire and respect you. They will know that their name is precious with you when they're not there. On the other hand, when loyalty is a higher value than integrity, in that you give in, go along, and join in the bad-mouthing, so too will everyone present know that under pressure and stress, you would do the same regarding them. I remember heading up a meeting in a large organization where the formal leaders were discussing various personnel issues. They seemed to be in complete agreement regarding the weaknesses of a particular individual. They even began to tell jokes and funny stories about this individual in ways that they would never do to the person's face. Later the same day, one of the executives came to me and said that for the first time he could now trust my expressions of appreciation and affection for him. "Why so?" I asked. He replied, "Because when we were cutting that person in our earlier meeting, you went against the current and showed genuine concern, care, and regard for him." I asked why that had impacted him. He said, "Because I have similar weaknesses, only they're worse. No one knows about them, not even you. So every time you've expressed your appreciation and regard for me, inwardly I've said, 'But you don't understand.' Today, I feel that you would. I feel that you would be true and loyal to me even in my absence, and that I can trust you and believe your kind expressions. You see, the key to the many is often the one. It is how you regard and talk about the one, in that one's absence or presence, that communicates to the many how you would regard and talk about them in their presence or absence." New heading, apologizing. To learn to say, "I was wrong, I'm sorry," or "I was on an ego trip, I overreacted, I ignored you, and I temporarily put loyalty above integrity," and then to live accordingly is one of the most powerful forms of apology you can make. I have literally seen relationships that have been broken for years redeemed in a relatively short period of time with the depth and sincerity of such an apology. If you said something under the heat of the moment but did not really mean it, when you apologize, explain how you were driven by your pride and what you really meant. If you said it in the heat of the moment and did mean it, then the nature of the apology will require you to actually change your heart, to privately repent until you can sincerely say, "I'm sorry. I was wrong in word and deed, and I'm working to correct both." I remember once having an unpleasant confrontation with an individual on a very jugular issue. The feelings affected the genuineness of our communication from then on, even though on the surface it seemed polite and pleasant. Then one day he came to me and said he felt sad about the strain in our relationship and wanted to restore it to its former unity and harmony. He said it was one of the most difficult things for him to do, to look into his own heart and see where he had gone wrong. He really wanted to apologize. His apology was so humble and sincere, without any form of self-justification, that it caused me to look into my own heart and to take responsibility for my part. We were knitted together again. A former colleague told me once of an experience she had working with a high-level executive team at a week-long retreat. The president began one morning by encouraging the group to really seek to listen, to understand others in their discussion before making their own points. Before moving on in the meeting, he shared a powerful personal experience illustrating his point. What follows is her brief account. The names have been changed, as they have been in many of the stories included in this book, of what happened later that afternoon. These are her words. In the middle of our discussions, a rather obnoxious executive started to say something about a business approach he was struggling with. The group verbally pounced on him. To be honest, I would have liked to pounce on him myself, but knew it wasn't my place. Then I heard Jack, the president, laughing out loud, right in this guy's face. He was actually making fun of him in front of the whole group. Of course, the group jumped on the bandwagon. I was stunned. Only a few hours before, the president had shared this moving experience about the value of waiting your turn, trying to understand a person's actions. Now he was doing the very opposite. I couldn't very well reprimand him in front of the whole group, so I just glared at him. He read me loud and clear. That was ugly. If you don't do something to rectify this right now, I'll walk out. Really, I was so angry I was ready to walk out on the whole group. They had just reverted to their old combative behavior and poisonous group dynamics. He stared back at me. I pulled myself up taller in my seat and glared. Back at you, pal. He shrunk back in his seat. I kept on looking right at him. This went on for about 5 minutes, during which his team members were still crucifying the poor guy. Then all of a sudden the president stopped the meeting, and he said, "Stop. I did something wrong. David, I want to ask your forgiveness." "For what?" David was a bit baffled. Things were normal as far as he knew. "That was inappropriate of me. I shouldn't have laughed. We didn't listen to you at all. We just jumped on you. Will you forgive me?" I thought that David, the senior vice president, would say something like, "No problem, don't worry about it." But his response was amazing. "Jack, I forgive you. Thank you." Do you realize how much more courage it takes to actively forgive rather than trying to forget something happened? I sat there. I was overwhelmed with emotion by Jack's behavior. He didn't have to apologize. He didn't have to seek forgiveness in front of the whole group. He's the head of an 80,000-person division. He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to. After the meeting, I went up to him with emotion still in my voice and said, "Thank you for doing that." He replied, "It was the right thing to do. Thank you for glaring at me." We didn't speak about that incident again, but we both knew we had risen to our best that day. New heading: Giving and Receiving Feedback. The students I am closest to from my years as a teacher are those I gave strong feedback to. "You're better than that. I won't let you off the hook. There are no excuses. You can pay the price." Many have told me that holding them to the responsible course, having them live with the full consequences of their actions, was a life-changing, defining moment, though hard for both of us at the time. Giving negative feedback is one of the most difficult communications there is. It is also one of the most needed. So many people have serious blind spots, they never come to grips because no one knows how to give them feedback. People are too fearful of rupturing a relationship or of having their personal future compromised by taking on their boss. The hypocrisy in the belittling situation in Jack's story became so evident to the offender that it wasn't an issue of having a blind spot, it was one of ego. The courage and integrity of the woman who gave the feedback were more powerful than status and position. That's why it worked. Sometimes it isn't more powerful and it won't work, which may necessitate going to the person privately and making a reconciliation. The best way to give feedback in a private circumstance is to describe yourself, not the person. Describe your feelings, your concerns, or your perceptions of what was happening rather than accusing, judging, and labeling the person. This approach often causes the other person to become open to information about his or her blind spot without being so personally threatened. People in authority should make pushing back and giving feedback legitimate. When you do receive feedback, you need to speak explicitly about it and express gratitude for it, however much it may hurt. If you don't do this explicitly, a norm will develop which basically says that giving negative feedback and pushing back is a form of disloyalty and insubordination. Making pushing back legitimate, even a social norm, also frees the person with formal authority so that he or she can also push back without fearing it will hurt feelings, rupture a relationship, or be taken as the final word. We all need feedback, particularly about our blind spots, those tender areas of weakness that we defend. That is why personal growth is so vital, because blind spots are not quite so tender. One's sense of worth is intrinsic, and it doesn't come from a particular weakness, known or blind. I remember once having a strain with one of my neighbors because of how difficult it was for him to live so close to our large, noisy, sometimes disrespectful family, complete with a barking dog and glaring lights early in the morning and late at night, etc. I went to him and basically said that I wanted us to be good neighbors and would appreciate his giving me feedback about what we could do to improve things. He hesitated to speak, so I primed the pump a little by describing what it must be like to live next door to us. He then opened up with a gush of feelings, complaints, and concerns that he and his wife had. But the more I listened, the more he seemed almost overwhelmed by my seeking this feedback, respecting it, and trying to involve my family in an effort to improve. He also acknowledged that he had overreacted to many things and had blown the whole thing out of proportion, that much of what he was talking about was the inevitable chatter, complexity, and confusion of a large family's comings and goings. As we parted, he said how grateful he was for the visit, and also how relieved he was. New heading, forgiving. Gandhi once said, "Anger is an acid that can do more harm to the vessel in which it stands than to anything on which it is poured." True forgiveness involves forgetting, letting it go, and moving on. While I was away on a business trip once, I received a call from one of my managers who wanted to resign because of how he was being criticized by his immediate supervisor. I asked him to hold off from making such a rash decision until we could get together. He said, "I'm not calling to counsel with you. I'm calling to inform you. I'm resigning." I realized then that I had not listened to him, which I then proceeded to do. He then opened up a Pandora's box of experiences, complaints, and feelings, including even stronger ones from his wife. As I genuinely listened, the negative energy in his expression was dissipated, and on his own, he agreed to visit with me as soon as I returned. When I returned, he brought his wife to my office, and they were pleasant on the surface. But as soon as we began to discuss the real issues, the deep anger and resentment gushed forth. I continued to listen until they felt understood, and then they became very open. I then taught them about the space between stimulus and response, and how the greatest harm is not what people do to us, but in our response to what they do to us. They initially thought I was manipulating to get him to stay on, so I continued listening until other issues were expressed and understood, including how those issues at work had affected their own marriage and family life. It was truly like peeling off the layers of an onion until you reach the soft inner core. By this time, they were extremely open and teachable, so I emphasized again their power of choice, and that they might consider asking his superior's forgiveness for the resentment and anger the manager held for his superior. His response was, "What do you mean? You've turned this whole thing about. It's not for us to seek forgiveness. It's for him to seek our forgiveness." More negative energy was released until they were extremely open to the whole idea that no one can do us any harm without our consent, and that our chosen response is the key determiner of our life, that we truly are a product of our decisions, not our conditions. They were very humbled and agreed to think about it. He later called me on the phone and said that he had come to see the wisdom of the principle we'd discussed, and he accepted it, and that he had gone to his boss and asked for forgiveness, that his boss was literally overwhelmed by this expression, and that he in turn had asked his forgiveness, and that it had restored their relationship. My friend said to me that he and his wife had reached such a point of accepting the space between stimulus and response and the power of choice that even if they had been rebuffed in their sincere seeking of forgiveness, he was determined to stay on and make a success of things as best he could. Dag Hammarskjöld once taught, "Forgiveness breaks the chain of causality, because he who forgives you out of love takes upon himself the consequences of what you have done. Forgiveness, therefore, always entails a sacrifice." Close quote. It isn't the poisonous snake bite that does the serious harm. It's chasing that snake that drives the venom to the heart. Because we all make mistakes, we all need to forgive and be forgiven. It is better to focus on our own mistakes and ask forgiveness than to focus on other people's mistakes, wait for them to ask for forgiveness first, or give it begrudgingly if they do. It is better to have the spirit of the one who prayed, "O Lord, please help me to forgive those who sin differently than I." In the same spirit, C.S. Lewis wrote, "When I come to my evening prayers and try to reckon up the sins